everybody. I'm Jacopo De Toni, and this is the FDI podcast. The European Union and Japan officially agreed on a trade deal on July 6th, thus creating the world's largest open economic area, covering about a third of the global economy and more than 600 million people. The deal eliminates most of the existing tariffs on goods and services flowing between the European Union and Japan, and also lifts some of the non-tariff barriers that somewhat limited mutual trade and particularly investment. It also comes at a time when global trade has lost the typical leadership of the United States, giving the European Union and Japan a chance to fill the void left by the White House in continuing trade and investment liberalization across the globe, and thus counter a mounting wave of protectionism. I'm here in our studio in London with Elitsa Garnisova, a researcher at the London School of Economics, who works as some insightful research into the potential impact of the EU-Japan EPA on trade and investment. So Elitsa, obviously the treaty has yet to be fully ratified by European Union countries and obviously also Japan, but assuming that it comes into force in 2019 as expected, how do you see trade and investment develop between the two blocks with this treaty?
So first of all, I think you touched upon the main points in terms of this is one of the largest agreements that has been signed yet by two parties. And I would definitely point out to three areas where the agreement is both very important for investment confidence, but also for development of future relations between the two countries. The three areas are definitely tariffs, regulatory issues, and a general improvement in the business environment. On the tariffs front, as you said, on day one, 90% of tariffs on trade in goods will be eliminated, which is a remarkable achievement. And even though Japan is already famous for its low tariffs on industrial goods, when it comes to areas that are of special interest of European exporters and a lot of offensive interests, this would be extremely beneficial. So, of course, tariffs is definitely the first point to point out to.
Like, for example, textile and these sectors where European companies
yeah.
are big...
Of course, and leather goods, where there has been an informal restrictions within the Japanese market. So this is a big growth area. Also, chemicals and a lot of the agricultural goods that received reductions through TRQs and other tariff reductions. So this is, of course, the main point. And of course, in order for this to qualify under WTO as a trade agreement, it has to. Liberalize substantially all trade. The second point that you also mentioned is actually more important and does link a lot to the research that we do, which is regulatory issues. And of course, nowadays we hear a lot about non-tariff measures and how important they are. But also in the case of Japan, given that it's already such a developed economy, that it has very low barriers to investment and low tariffs, actually non-tariff barriers were the most important area on which to the EU to crack on. And the EU did, I think, an amazing job in getting to discuss with Japan and put forward these. In the end of the day, the partnership is about creating a forum to discuss this regulatory issue. So there are a few dimensions of that. So there is, of course, the horizontal provisions, but there are also very in-depth sectoral annexes for motor vehicles, for textiles that you mentioned, avoiding duplicate labeling, also for medical devices. And financial services. And even more interestingly, of course, there is the joint body for cooperation and for discussion of future cooperation between the EU and Japan, where the idea is to actually avoid future, as much as possible to avoid future barriers, which is one of the most important things nowadays, really.
Right. So this is an interesting point because often Japan is perceived by Western investors as a difficult place to do business in, despite a very favorable business environment, at least on paper, like very few restrictions to trade, very few restrictions to investment. But again, there are non-tariff barriers or soft barriers that are perceived as a hurdle to trade and investment. So do you want to give us a few examples of a few measures and fields where they try to address non-tariff barriers which could potentially facilitate trade and investment from the European Union?
In terms of the annexes that the EU worked on the most, it's actually sort of a combination between unilateral action on the Japanese side, which was very important to show trust between two partners. That's quite important nowadays. Everybody talks about trust. And the Japanese, in that sense, showed a lot of commitment to reduce different types of barriers. So motor vehicles, they adopted the UNEC standards. So avoiding a lot of duplicate testing. And moving towards mutual recognitions of standards. There is a lot in terms of the textile sector, products in Japan had to be relabeled for the Japanese market. This is to be removed. There is also sort of mostly on the unilateral side in terms of medical devices. Japan took a lot of steps in order to get into, to make a reform of its internal market in terms of pharmaceuticals in order to avoid very sort of very complex bureaucratic procedures and high costs for European exporters. And pharmaceuticals is a huge market for, of course, nowadays. For European exporters. So these are just some of the examples, but also we have in the field of services, even Japan Post, some steps in order to reduce the monopoly of Japan Post in the country, but also on government procurement, there is now access to trading with or providing services to cities in Japan. So these are all, it used to be sort of a no-go for European exporters and creates a lot of trust between the two partners.
Right. Obviously, it's the treaty is going to work both ways, so there will be a lot of, like, also investment and trade from Japan will be facilitated into European Union will be facilitated. We'll get to that in a minute. But I wanted also to talk about, like, its potential impact on not just trade, on investment. I think that in a way this treaty is particular because it doesn't really open a market that was already open, but in a way it makes it more, eliminates or reduces business costs related to doing business in Japan, which is, again, not just perceived as a difficult, sometimes could be perceived as a difficult place to do business in, but also a very competitive and tough market in a way. It's an expensive market. It's a place where profit margins not necessarily are that high as other Asian countries. So in a way, this deal probably makes, as you were mentioning, like your retail kind of reduces business costs related to labeling, for example, or in other sectors. So probably creates more, it reduces business costs. So by doing so, increases profit margins for foreign trade partners, and thus makes it a more appealing market. Talking about the potential impact on investment from the economic partnership agreement between the European Union and Japan, I spoke with Mr. Ozuki Makiyama, the director of the European Center for International Political Economy, and this is what he told me.
I think that there is a difference in objective between Europe and Japan, because Europe is desperate for foreign investment. And it is actually quite underperforming in terms of investment overall, domestic or foreign. And this is one of the underlying problems of the European economy that is quite structural. Actually, the structural problem for Japan is the opposite, meaning that Japan is over-liquid. It's one of the most liquid, it is the most liquid market in the world. And they have a surplus of capital. And now you would ask yourself, if you're on the Japanese market, and you have a surplus of capital, which for a number of years that has been practically free, why would you go overseas to get money? And that's a fundamental problem for Japan. And one of the things that the current administration in Japan, or the Prime Minister Abe, is trying to do is that despite this uphill for foreign direct investment, they need to actually attract FDI simply for the fact that they need more competitive market. They want more competition. And with that, of course, comes a number of competitiveness factors that if you attract foreign competition, you may be able to, for example, improve consumer welfare. You may bring some dynamics back to the Japanese market. Another important factor that you can actually see, for example, in certain sectors, for example, in life sciences, is that they want to bring more innovative drugs and medical devices, as well as hopefully through competitive pressure, bring the cost down in elderly care and in the aging society, and also find new solutions for rare diseases and so forth. So there are a number of factors that, for the Japanese side, it's not just about attracting capital. It's actually secondary. Attracting capital is a way to actually reach another objective.
So in a way, it's been very clear. So they are not after capital per se, but they want Western capital or Western companies active in the local market to take the market to the next level, to a more sophisticated stage, to a more competitive stage, and therefore eventually also increase the welfare of the consumers.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with Hosok that in terms of the importance of the economic partnership agreements is to an extent quite different to some extent for the Japanese side and for the European side, because Europe really needs growth and jobs, and it's still trying to push for some of those structural reforms that are actually underway in Japan right now. While for Japan is really part of the Abenomics program and how it would sort of shape in the next few years. And the economic partnership agreement is a key point of that, because it does include business environment substantially in terms of promoting, also in terms of just thinking about the academic studies on the topic in how trade liberalization then brings with it further foreign direct investment, and it improves business confidence. So really, as you said, promoting investment in the long term, which would be really important for both Japan and the EU.
On the other hand, what can we expect for investment, Japanese investment into the European Union? Japanese companies are already major investors in European Union and countries, not just in the automotive sector, which is the easy guess, but across the board, like financials, chemicals, and engineering, and so on and so forth. What is it? Should we expect this inflow of capital, Japanese capital, to grow even further after this agreement?
Oh, definitely. And especially, again, thinking about the business environment, when we were conducting the sustainability impact assessment during the negotiations, one of the main concerns of Japanese investors was actually, again, regulatory issues, the regulatory environment in the EU, when it comes to mode four services in terms of the presence of investors, the easiness of linking together people across the two partners. So these are all areas that are addressed by the agreement. And in that sense, we can definitely see some positive areas on that front. So even in terms of not just movement of people for business purposes, but of investors and their families. And these are, even though it seems like a minor detail, is quite important for the Japanese side. And we're definitely going to see with that a lot of confidence building in on the EU side as well.
Is there any specific point about, we know that in both in Japan and the European Union, probably the most protected sector is the agriculture sector. So are they also opening up agriculture for trade, particular investment, both in Japan and the European Union?
So the European Union is, of course, produces a lot more on the agricultural front than Japan. So the direction is mostly EU exporting to Japan rather than vice versa. And then there is a huge market again for it on the Japanese side. So I think that's the major effect on the agricultural front.
All right. Obviously, when it comes to Japanese investment into the European Union, we are getting out to the B word, to Brexit. The UK is supposed to remain a European Union country until March 2019. We don't know yet what will be the post-Brexit scenario, but definitely, unless there is a second referendum, which is still kind of a far away alternative or like scenario right now, the country will leave the European Union. And we know that Japanese, the future of Japanese investment in the country has been a major issue since the very beginning. Japanese, again, automakers, car producers, they employ a thousand of people, Nissan and others, they employ a thousand of people across the country. And there's always been a priority. Theresa May, Prime Minister, has always been very vocal since the very beginning in trying to protect this investment, protect this interest, and keep this investment within the country. But what happens now with this treaty? Obviously, this treaty puts the European Union in a much better position in a scenario where the UK leaves totally the single market and the customs union, and we'll have to renegotiate eventually if they want their own deal with free trade deal with Japan. Talking about the potential impact on investment from the economic partnership agreement between the European Union and Japan, I spoke to Mr. Ozuki Makiyama, the director of the European Center for International Political Economy, and this is what he told me.
If you're in this current political uncertainty that we live under now, Japanese business traditionally shy away from uncertainties. They prefer legal certainties, and then sometimes even prefer regulatory complex market as long as the legal situation is certain. And so obviously this is going to have a major impact. What the free trade agreement now does between EU, Japan, and vis-a-vis the UK is that even if the UK would actually sign a trade agreement that is an exact replica of the agreement that Europe just signed with Japan itself, we will be looking at some relocation of manufacturing resources and some plants out of the UK. I think that is inevitable, and that's just a simple economic fact. In the long term, it won't be possible to service the single market just out of the UK unless you have a very, very soft form of Brexit that at least contains a customs union. So it's not so much a question about what the EU-Japan agreement will lead to. Yes, it is true that under a reasonably assumable scenario of Brexit, you can now access the single market at same trading costs from Nagoya as you would do from Sunderland. That's inevitable. But in fact, whether these investments stay in the UK or not, it's actually a question about what kind of Brexit you would have.
So yeah, this is kind of obviously it's a bit of a stretch, but it actually works this way. So in a future scenario, in a scenario of a hard Brexit, probably it's going to be cheaper to access the European Union market from Japan than from Sunderland or from anywhere else in the United Kingdom. So what's your take on it? Do you agree on the fact that Councillor May, there will be relocations?
I mean, it's very, very tricky. Of course, Brexit is, of course, Hosuk put a lot of focus on this, creates a lot of uncertainty. And I think that Japanese businesses are very pragmatic, so they'll try not to leave on day one. And of course, London and the UK will remain a hub in many areas. So that might lessen, or if you try to paint a more positive picture, of course, not everything will go totally bad. But a recent study by the Center for Economic Performance at DLSE actually tried to estimate how much of the effect of the UK being as member of the EU created an effect on FDI. And according to their estimations and their convergence with other studies, there will be a decrease of by almost 22% in FDI, right, inward FDI in the UK. So that's a major thing to think about. And of course, the Japanese government and the ambassador of Japan to the UK has also been very vocal that this is not a great situation to be in. They've been sort of tempted to open businesses and more than 1,000 operations in the UK. And now they're in a very tricky spot of what to do. And I do agree with Hosok that to an extent Japanese companies might at some point be at a better level. But there is also the other side that while there is a transition between sort of once the EU-Japan Economic Partnership Agreement kicks in and Britain is out of the EU, then in the transition while the UK negotiates its own agreement with Japan, then there will be a first mover advantage for a lot of the EU companies. And even though not in all areas, they're not direct competitors of EU companies in all areas, that would definitely create a first come, first serve basis for EU companies. So another effect to think about in terms of the bilateral relations.
You think that Brexit was an element that EU negotiators had in their mind when they you know, when negotiating this agreement and when, you know, eventually the timing of the signing of the agreement is actually placed well in their hands for, you know, if we look at where the Brexit negotiation stand today and what is the agenda there. So do you think that there was also a Brexit element in the mind of European negotiators?
Not necessarily. I would say that as somebody who's worked for the European Commission as a consultant, as part of LSE Consulting, what we've seen is that for them, we are still keeping the UK in all of our analysis. It's part of all of the modeling. It's still part of the EU. And it's very much will be like that until there is a deal or no deal upon withdrawal. So I think that very much in the when it comes to the thinking of the European Commission, what is important, and then it was quite challenging when we were doing the SAA, the most important things were the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the losses for the EU as a result of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was a much bigger deal. Right. So the EU-Japan agreement was timed in a way to try to reduce some of the losses from trade diversion from TPP. And that was a much bigger sort of global factor to play in the calculations. Right. For me, at least, that's... and that's something we saw with the impact assessment that we did, that we tried to be quite innovative about it and not look at just EU-Japan, but look at EU-Japan in each of their respective hubs in terms of Japan's role in Asia-Pacific and then EU's role in the transatlantic relations and try to position this more broadly.
So this is a very interesting point, and this kind of leads perfectly to my last question. Obviously, the signing of the treaty comes at a time, a very particular time, and the timing is very meaningful. So on the one hand, we are seeing the White House, so it's like, you know, pulling the brakes on trade liberalization. Obviously, they pulled out of the TPP. They imposed it. Now there is this kind of unfolding trade dispute or trade war with China, and they raised tariffs on aluminium and other imports from traditional trade partners, including European Union, even though today they seem to have agreed to kind of lift the tariffs and keep talking about like possible future trade deal. So this is happening in the US, but on the other hand, there is Japan and the European Union that they seem to be willing or committed to fill in the void in a way left by the White House in continuing trade and investment liberalization across the globe. So how do you see this unfolding? Do you see the European and Japan really emerging as new leaders of or new champions of trade liberalization and globalization, and trying again to counter this mounting protection wave of protectionism that we have experienced in the past couple of years?
I mean, the partnership agreement is a key milestone in this. And as you said, the timing couldn't be perfect, couldn't be any better when it comes to the global the global developments. And I think that there is a lot of convergence in the thinking between EU and Japan, especially on some of the things that we mentioned in terms of even thinking about how to deal with regulatory issues, creating different bodies where they try to avoid future divergence, which is really important. And I think that there is also more and more coordination on even issues relating to China, but also discussing the reactions of the US. I think that the EU was very strategic and in terms of thinking about the long-term developments in trade policy, which is actually a long-term game. It's not something that you see the results on day one necessarily. Right. So in terms of the timing, EU signing an agreement with Japan before the US is in itself, I think, a big achievement, and would help with, definitely getting the two parties to cooperate more in different areas and getting to be very unified in their positions.
And the European Union has got already now moving on to the next treaties. They got open negotiations with Australia and New Zealand. They got negotiation ongoing with the Mercosur bloc. They got negotiation modernization of the treaty with Chile, and talks, we don't know where they will, they are going. We don't know, what's the final outcome, the final target of the talk with the US, but still, again, today's news, Mr. Trump and Jean-Claude Juncker, they met in Washington and they said they will continue to talk trade. There is plenty of work for European negotiators at the moment.
Yeah, completely. They're very, very busy. And especially, I think that, of course, EU-Mercosur hopefully is just around the corner. The EU-Mexico was just agreed at the political level, which is really important. Again, thinking about the North American situation and how the EU has now a very good treaty with Canada and now has modernized its treaty, or it's in the process of modernizing its treaty with Mexico, sort of building this to an extent alliance on both sides of the US in some ways. But also Australia and New Zealand are very key in the move towards Asia Pacific as well. This is, as you said, the very key negotiating partners, developed economies, very similar thinking on regulatory issues, and that will be really important in the negotiations. In terms of the US, of course, I'm very skeptical because the EU-Japan negotiations were during the time of the TTIP negotiations, and we actually witnessed firsthand the whole backlash towards the agreement with the US. Right. So any step on the side of EU and the US to introduce a TTIP light at this stage might be perceived as doing the same sort of liberalization and empowering corporates from sort of the back door rather than following official channels. So here the process will be very important. Maybe not that much in the US. I don't know the system too well, but in terms of how the EU process work, I think that it will be very tough for the EU to promote an ambitious agreement or any agreement with the US without facing a lot of trouble in different constituencies across the EU. Yeah. So that will be major deal too.
All right. Well, Eliza Gardintsova, a researcher at the London School of Economics, thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can follow this episode and any other previous episode of the FDI podcast on our website, fdiintelligence.com/podcast, and on Acast or iTunes. Stay tuned, and until the next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.